as interpreted by me. So I'm giving you that warning beforehand. Yeah, so I want to talk about just a little bit of history about what I consider to be one of the sort of best examples of an applied mathematics. Basically a mathematician talking to a biologist and in some ways deriving some of the fundamental equations for genetics that are still fundamental and relevant today. And we'll do a little bit of math on the board, but it's not going to be too intensive of a talk. So genetics and the theory of genetics that we know today didn't always exist. Back in the 1800s, Gregor Mendel, who is now considered by many to be in some sense the founder of genetics, he lived in Germany and he studied philosophy and physics. And then he went on to become a monk, and he lived in a monastery, although he wasn't the kind of monk that couldn't not leave the monastery. So he would leave the monastery and continue in science and give talks and stuff, and he would... And he got really interested in the theory of hybridization and inheritance, and so he did lots of experiments at his monastery. What has become his most important work was a large-scale set of experiments he did with pea plants over a span of 8 years. Essentially, using about 30,000 different pea plants, he did a bunch of experimentation on hybridization. And all of the experiments essentially went something like he would plant a bunch of pea peas that he knew were hybrid, meaning that in some characteristic, let's say if they were green or yellow, he planted a bunch of seeds that he knew came from... one green-colored parent and one yellow-colored parent. And he documented the colors of the peas in the next generation. And he did this with lots of different characteristics of peas, not just colors, but also the shape, whether the pea was round or wrinkled, long or short stem length, and the positions of the flowers on the peas. And he kept observing that about one in every four children peas would have purebred recessive factors, meaning that they would take on the characteristic that was less common in the population, so yellow-colored peas. And he observed that one in four of the children had the dominant characteristics, or was green, and also was not a hybrid, and that one half were hybrids. And he jotted all this down, and he wrote this paper called Experiments in Plant Hybridization, where he gave all of the results of this work in 1865. And he talked about these dominant and recessive characteristics as being factors. We now know that they come from genes that are on our chromosomes, but none of this was known in Mendel's time. He had no microscope. He had no way to look inside the peas. He just noted this. And you might think that this was, this was a big thing. This was a lot of work. This was a big deal. And these were the first well-documented experiments that showed that a lot of our characteristics are in discrete form, particulate form. But his paper only had about 3 citations in his lifetime. So when he died in 1884, it was essentially... it was essentially nothing to the scientific community. And this wasn't because he lived in a monastery. He went out and he gave talks about this paper at conferences, and people knew about it in the field of hybridization. But just at the time that Mendel did these experiments, the overwhelming belief in the community of biologists was that it was in a sort of blended theory of inheritance, that of course a child's characteristics have to be an average of their parents' characteristics. If you have a tall father and a short mother, then you're going to be an average of them. And we do observe a lot of this, which we now know is sort of a large law of large number effect from a bunch of small discrete characteristics, right? That they can make it look like you have blendings of your parents' characteristics, but underlying, there's this particulate discrete nature. And so even Darwin believed believed in this blended theory, just like Newton believed in what is the theory of turning things into gold?
Alchemy.
It's always funny to, or reassuring sort of, to know that these huge minds were really human, and not all of their theories, you know, were true in hindsight. So that's what happened, and it wasn't until the 1880s, 1890s, when microscopes became developed enough that people could observe under the microscope cell divisions, the division of human cells, and they observed chromosomes, or these long X-shaped rods, they said. And they saw that, you know, we got one chromosome from the mother and one from the father, and it started to make more sense that maybe there was a particulate theory of inheritance, that underlying there were some discrete factors. And in 1900, beginning of the 1900s, Mendelian genetics was essentially rediscovered. This 3-to-1 ratio of dominant characteristics to recessive characteristics. And then researchers went back and found Mendel's paper after they had essentially rediscovered it and realized, wow, this guy was really before his time. The world wasn't ready for what he had noted in experiment. But still, there was no mathematical justification for why you don't see the dominant characteristic just generation after generation take over in the population, as in some sense intuitive, you would think. Maybe the part of the confusion stems from the fact that it's called dominant and it shouldn't actually be called dominant. But very famous biologists like Yule stood out and said that there's something wrong with this theory because, you know, otherwise you would see everyone with brown eyes, you would see all green peas, you wouldn't see these yellow peas. And another biologist, Punnett, he was studying at Cambridge in graduate school and talked to people who weren't just biologists. And he had a friend named Godfrey or Jeffrey, he's referred to as both, Hardy. And Punnett believed in the theory of Mendelian or particulate inheritance, and he asked Hardy if he could come up with mathematical proof to prove Yule wrong, that in fact, mathematically, there was some equilibrium in which the dominant and recessive genes were both present and maintained stability in a population. So G. Hardy figured out some mathematical equations. I think they say that it took him a day or something. Once he knew the problem, once he had talked to Punnett and learned about the biological background and heard of the problem, and so Hardy wrote the editor of Science his findings. And as you can tell, just by Hardy's language, he has a bit of disdain for anything that's not pure mathematics. To the editor of Science, I am reluctant to intrude on a discussion concerning matters of which I have no expert knowledge, and I should have expected the very simple point which I wish to make to have been familiar to biologists. However, some remarks of Mr. Udney Yule, to which Mr. R.C. Punnett has called my attention, suggest that it may still be worth making. That's how he starts. And then he continues a little bit more and describes his solution and says a little mathematics of the multiplication table type is enough to show that in the next generation, the proportions of dominant to hybrid to recessive genotypes has this formula. So now I'm going to stop a minute and just set up the problem and derive for you Hardy's equilibrium equations. But keep in mind, looking at his picture and his tone, this is he obviously thought this was simple. I don't know if we should turn a light on, but I'm just going to write something down on the board. Okay, so the setup here, and I think I learned this. I mean, I didn't get the rigorous mathematical justification, but I learned the setup of this in high school, and I remember being really excited. Like, this is like an application of mathematics. This is pretty cool. And I'm still excited about it today. It's still interesting to me. So suppose that we have a gene, which is a segment of DNA, and it can take two discrete forms, two distinct forms, capital A or little a. Say it has two alleles, two forms it could take. And we carry two copies of each gene. So each of us has two alleles for each gene. And so if you look at all the unordered pairs of these two alleles, well, they're three distinct unordered pairs. And a pair of alleles together is called a genotype. So there are three possible genotypes in the population. So let's say that we have a large population, and we have a fraction of P capital A, capital A genotypes. So we're going to call these purebred dominant. Or we'll just call them dominant. Genotypes in the population. And then 2Q, I'm say putting 2 here because it'll just be easier to for the formulas. So 2Q fraction of hybrid genotypes. So they have one allele of dominant and one recessive allele. And R pure recessive genotypes. So the rule is that if you have either both dominant alleles or just one dominant allele, then you're going to look the same. It's going to have the same phenotype or same, you know, in the ideal case, you can't tell just by looking at someone whether they have two dominant or one dominant. So this would be, say, brown eyes. And then if you have two copies of the recessive allele, then you have a different phenotype. It's expressed as a different physical characteristic. And so what Hardy showed was that in a population that's... Let me quickly explain the process of how mating occurs, okay? The birds and the bees. Let me explain it to you. That's going on camera. Okay, so... So the mother and the father each, you know, for a particular gene, each have a distinct genotype. So they each have two copies, or two alleles. And a mating you essentially say if you pick a mother who has a purebred dominant and a father, which is, say, has a recessive gene, then the child will randomly get one allele from the mother and one allele from the father. So in the cross between a pure dominant and pure recessive, the only possible child that can result is a hybrid. But, if both mother and father are pure recessive, then the child has to be recessive. Which is why when I had a friend in high school, and, you know, both of her parents had blue eyes and she had brown eyes, I was a little confused. But it does happen, but sometimes you have to be concerned. So what Hardy showed was that if the population is sufficiently large, then we can consider, and if all of the mating is random, then you can think of this as a problem of drawing one allele from the mother at random with replacement. Each mating, you essentially can replace one of the populations big. And same with the father. So what is the fraction of the dominant allele in the population? If we have P and 2Q and R are the genotype proportions. Okay, so now I'm going, what is the fraction of big allele? Big A. So let's call this, let's say that theta is the fraction of the dominant allele A in the population. call that theta. Well, then you're going to have two for each P, so 2P, and then you're going to have one big A for each of the hybrids, so 2Q, because I've normalized, or I've called this fraction 2Q to start with, divided by essentially 2P plus 4Q plus 2R, which is 2 times, you know, all of the fractions. And so because this normalizes to 2, we just get P plus Q is the fraction of dominant allele in the population. And so, of course, the fraction of recessive allele is just 1 minus that. And so Hardy showed that if we assume a large population in random mating, the process of random mating is essentially just choosing from the mother a dominant allele with probability P plus Q, or a recessive allele with probability 1 minus that. And same for the father. So we have assumed a bunch of balls, and this proportion of them are dominant, and the rest is recessive. And so then you derive that the expected proportion of, so in the second generation, let's call the fractions of genotypes P prime to Q prime and R prime. Okay? So Hardy showed that the expected fraction of dominant genotypes, using this model of random mating, would just be what? This proportion times this proportion, or this squared. And then if the population of children is large enough, then you can drop this expectation and say that the number is going to be really close to its expectation. Okay, so there's some hand-waving here because it's biology. No. Okay, so Hardy derived that, okay, this will be the population of dominant in the second generation. 2Q prime will be equal to the proportion of capital A times the proportion of little a times 2, because you could also do this. So can everyone see this over here? So this will be 2 times P plus Q times 1 minus P plus Q, which turns out to be P plus R, because P plus 2Q plus R equals 1. And finally, the second generation fraction of recessive alleles will just be Q plus R squared. And now, that's all he wrote here on the board. That's all he said. So this is essentially, he wrote a three-paragraph letter to science saying this. And then at the end, he says, the interesting question is, in what circumstances will this distribution be the same as that in the generation before, showing that you have an equilibrium distribution? He said, it is easy to see that the condition for this is that the proportion of hybrids squared divided by 4 is equal to the proportions of recessive and dominant. Q squared equals PR. And since, this Q1 should be Q prime. Q prime squared equals P prime R prime. Whatever the values of P, Q, and R may be, the distribution will in any case continue unchanged after the second generation. So all he means by that is that you can show from these equations that P prime, 2Q prime, and R prime will remain the proportions for every single generation to come after, you know, just this one generation of shuffling. Because just from this, we can derive that it's equilibrium if P prime is equal to what it would be after the next generation, P prime plus Q prime squared, plus one more, but I'll just show you this and I'm sure you'll be convinced. So we just need to verify this. And so just plugging this in, we have P plus Q, and we want to show that P plus Q squared is equal to P plus Q squared plus P plus Q times P plus R. Squared. Okay. So, cancel the squares, or take the square root of both sides, and dividing by P plus Q, this reduces to having that 1 is equal to P plus Q plus P. Sorry, this should be Q plus R. Sorry. This is the proportion of recessive alleles, so it's Q is the, 2Q was the proportion of hybrids. So P plus Q plus Q plus R equals P plus 2Q plus R, which is all of the proportions. P plus 2Q plus R, of course, is equal to 1. So that's the proof that he wrote into science in 1908. Any questions? So for Mendel's peas, Mendel started with only hybrid peas, meaning that if they're all hybrid, we're going to have initially the same number of dominant as recessive alleles in the population. And so that means that the alleles, the proportions are going to remain constant from generation to generation, and the number of dominant genotypes will stay at 1/4 proportion, number of hybrids will remain at 1/2 fraction of the population, and number of recessive will be in 1/4. So we'll see 3/4 green peas and 1/4 yellow peas. But for genes where the recessive allele is something detrimental or dangerous, you often see proportions of the recessive allele being much smaller than 1/2 in the population. So it's not always that you have 1/4 and 3/4 as your fractions. Okay. Well, as it turns out, and as happens a lot in the history of mathematics, there was a guy, a gynecologist named Wilhelm Weinberg in Germany, who also independently of Hardy came up with these same equations in 1908. Same year. That happens a lot. So now it's called the Hardy-Weinberg principle. And these are called the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium equations. Okay, let's go back to Hardy, because he's interesting. And his story is quite ironic, I think. So Hardy actually, he's regarded as one of the most important mathematicians that has ever lived. He did numerous achievements in analysis, number theory. He sort of discovered and was the mentor of this Ramanujan. I didn't say that right. How do you say it? Ramanujan. Ramanujan. So everyone together. Ramanujan. He was his mentor, and he himself says that discovering Ramanujan was his best achievement. And one of Hardy's most passionate opinions is that he did not like applied mathematics. And at the time that he was studying, applied math was considered using mathematics for military operations and such. So you can understand in that context why he might have more disdain and felt before the beginning of World War II that he needed to write a book about how much he did not like applied mathematics. And so in A Mathematician's Apology, which is still, I really recommend that everyone read this book. It really gives a lot of insight into you know, the mind of the way a mathematician works. They say that he wrote this book. Well, one of the reasons for writing this book, I think, is that he was trying to sell pure math over applied math, say. But he bragged that I have never done anything useful. No discovery of mine is made or is likely to make, indirectly or directly, for good or ill, the least difference in the amenity of the world. So it's really ironic that, in particular, if you now Google Hardy Littlewood, Littlewood was his constant mathematical collaborator who developed some of his most important work with. It's Googled about 1/30th of the time as Hardy Weinberg is Googled. So that's what people care about, I guess. But I don't think Hardy would be too upset if he were alive today, because I think that the Hardy Weinberg equilibrium equations and principle is actually pretty objectively good uses for applications. For instance, I mean, now this is when you hear DNA evidence in court and you say that, you know, this DNA could only belong to someone else with probability 1 in a million or whatever. They're making these they're calculating these probabilities assuming these Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium equations. They're saying this person could have this gene and this one and this one and this one and this one. And if you intersect all of these probabilities, so Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium is used a lot in forensic science and also evolutionary biology. And I don't know of any uses in the military yet. So let's see. So there are a lot of generalizations of the Hardy-Weinberg principle. I mean, you can imagine that. So this is a nice sort of this is a nice probabilistic model. You can imagine that a mathematician could have a field's day looking at all sorts of modifications of this model. Like you introduce some mutation, or there's non-random mating, or there's migration in the population. And as a mathematician, you can go in and you can model that, and you can prove lots of stuff. But unfortunately, having such mathematical equations be so apparently justified in the biological evidence, that's less well understood. And a lot of times when you add like mutation or migration or inbreeding to the model, the equilibrium equations become not tractable analytically, and you have to resort to doing simulation. But some of the generalizations are tractable and simple. For example, lots of our genes have more than two alleles and can have many different alleles. And Hardy-Weinberg principle extends without problem. If you have R alleles for some gene, then a system's in equilibrium if the proportion of individuals with alleles AJ and AK is proportional to the product of the fractions of the two alleles in the population. So, for example, blood type our blood types are determined by more than two alleles.
Eye color is
two. Yeah, I mean, actually, I can't really think of anything that's determined by actually just one gene. I mean, two alleles. Because there's usually one or two that are just really rare in the population. Their proportions are just really small. And sometimes new alleles are discovered for genes that were thought to have only a couple alleles until new ones are discovered. And just these equations, the way that we our genes and who we are, it's similar to the law of mass action in chemical kinetics, where the rate of transformation of compounds is proportional to their relative concentrations. Just because the likelihood, I mean, this is related to, you know, the likelihood of compounds reacting in terms of, you know, the heat of the system and how fast they move and the likelihood of them reacting being proportional to their concentrations. So there are all these similarities. So one of the seemingly most restrictive assumptions here that Hardy made is that there's complete random mating in the population. Now, obviously, since you reach the stable equilibrium after one generation of mating, this is a very sort of stable criterion. Like, it's not like an unstable equilibrium. It's technically called a neutral equilibrium. Neutral meaning that if the allele proportions are changed, then you just jump to a different set of equilibrium equations in the next generation. And that's why it's still a pretty valid assumption to make in the human population, even though we're obviously not completely random mating. Inbreeding. Oh, that's the first one? That's not supposed to be the most underlying non-random factor. But physical location, definitely. You're more likely to mate with people in your physical location. There's also a lot of evidence towards, you know, bias towards mating with people that look like you, if not inbreeding. And that's why, actually, there's a pretty relative constant within human subpopulations, like Caucasians or African American at least, of there being more pure dominant and pure recessive individuals than what would be if we were in complete Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. So that's called an inbreeding coefficient, essentially. And there is a model. There is a model that for which you can derive the equilibrium equations if here in the mating you're a little bit more likely to mate with people who are, so if you have brown eyes, more likely to mate with someone with brown eyes, and if you have blue eyes, more likely to mate with someone with blue eyes. Obviously that one's, But in general, you can incorporate that and derive a new system and get equilibrium equations. And in the extreme case that brown-eyed people only mate with brown-eyed people and blue-eyed people only mate with blue-eyed people, as it turns out, then asymptotically all hybrid genotypes will vanish in the population. And this is a little bit what's happening with dog breeding, in that dogs are purposefully mated with dogs that look a certain way. I always thought it was really interesting that we like inbred dogs, but that's why, anyway. So they're not going to be in Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium at all, dogs, domesticated dogs. And I know it's short, but it's late in the day, and that's pretty much most of what I wanted to talk about. Let me just tell you where I come into this and why I'm interested in this. So Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium is a pretty stable, or being near equilibrium, is a pretty stable indicator that a certain population is not evolving with respect to a particular gene. Okay. Evolution occurs when you have a random mutation, say, that has an advantage, and then the proportions change as individuals with that new allele have a selective advantage, and so then you'll see, of course, Hardy-Weinberg will be violated. So as we can't really take the genetic profile of every individual of population that we're interested in, usually one has a random sample from a population, and they look at the genotypes of the random sample, and need a statistical test to infer from the random sample, from the underlying distribution, you know, whether the system is in equilibrium or not. And traditionally a chi-squared test of significance developed by Carl Pearson in 1900 was sort of the benchmark used for testing Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. But it turns out that the chi-squared statistic, now that we have computers and can do Monte Carlo simulation, we can use many other different statistics or measures of distance between probability distributions that are much more powerful for use in detecting, for instance, deviations from Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. And chi-squared statistic is... it was introduced in 1900 because it has an asymptotic chi-squared distribution, so you would look up on a table of chi-squared values and be able to... You might have done this in your statistics class, and be able to assign a p-value for the test and everything. But now with Monte Carlo simulation, you know, tables are antiquated. So this is a pretty, believe it or not, active area of research today in statistics. And in particular, methods for studying Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. So this is a very alive topic, and that's where my interest comes from. But the most important conclusions to be drawn from this story are not the Hardy-Weinberg equations, I think, but that, one, don't be discouraged if you don't have a million citations. If you go to graduate school and then you write a paper that you think is amazing and somehow it doesn't get a lot of citations, it's okay, because Mendel's paper got 3. And now it's considered one of the most important papers in science ever to be written. People just aren't smart enough, that's all. That's, you can, you know, and half the time what I'm saying is true. Half the time... By half the time, I don't mean half of all papers written. I mean half of the papers that, in hindsight, are some of the most important papers. So, also in hindsight, you know, these equilibrium equations seem really trivial, and, you know, especially if you do some really complicated math, you might not understand exactly why it took people so long to understand, you know, the results of what Mendel was getting with his P's, or why Mendel himself didn't figure it out. But in my opinion, as an applied mathematician, I'm just going to say that I think this is, you know, some of the best applied math, because in applied math, I think the hardest part is talking to the biologists or the engineers and learning their language and communicating and being able to just pose what the important math problem is. And that's what happened between Punnett and Hardy. And although Hardy laughed at it, you know, he's getting a lot of Google hits, so that's it. I'm done.
Anyone have any questions?
Yeah?
How long after Hardy submitted his letter to the editor did the biology community kind of take a step back and say?
It was pretty fast.
Okay.
They understood.
Okay. No,
you're right, but in that case, because a lot of biologists wanted the justification. They had, at that point, they were ready for it. They saw the experimental evidence, and they just needed a justification. Yeah?
In your opinion, like, which assumption is more interesting to relax on, like the infant and the people in the population or the random mating?
Random mating, because... Well, mathematically interesting, I think. It's the different non-random mating or
maybe like unstable
equilibrium. Yeah. That's more math. That's interesting from a dynamics point of view. Having a small population usually just means that you're going to have some intractable equations and probabilities that, I don't know, with a small population, it's not clear that statistical things can be said. Maybe a biologist would probably say something different, but...
Any other questions? All right, let's thank our speaker again.